Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist.
And I am Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist with the First Steps program in Louisville, Kentucky. How are you, Laura?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Okay, we have a packed show today. We have five questions that we're taking. And so how many minutes per question would that be, Kate? 12 minutes maybe?
Why do we bother spending time and figuring it out? Because we're really going to spend as much time as it takes, and we'll probably flow over into next week. So I'm not going to do the math on that.
I don't know either, but a lot of these things are things that we've talked about before, and so what I'm going to try to do, too, is if there's a previous show where we really talked about something that I can kind of pull up what show number it is, I might give a show number for that.
Too,
so a mom might be able to go back and listen to that from our archives. And to do that, if you can either access that if you're getting us directly at blogtalkradio.com, or you can go to my website at teachmetotalk.com, look over in the right-hand column for the Blog Talk Radio icon, and then go backwards to find the show that you're looking for. So I wanted to mention that. Okay, let's just dive right into today. The first one is from an SEIT, which is a special education itinerant teacher. I looked that up. So she's a person like Kate.
I was going to say, I was impressed you knew that, because I didn't.
I looked it up. I Googled it. So I thought she was some kind of teacher, but I didn't really know exactly what those initials stood for, because
right.
Every state's a little different. So she is one of you. So we'll get started with her question. It says, I love your website. I'm a new SEIT, and I'm working with children that mainly have speech delays, although that is not my primary field. I guess not ironically, children with speech delays also have cognitive delays, especially when it comes to social play skills and following directions. No kidding. I've been able to gather from your articles what I have been doing correctly, which is being bubbly and encouraging. Thankfully, that was something I gained from working in a special ed preschool for many years prior to becoming an SEIT. And what I can use more of, like consistently requiring them to respond during play. She says, I'm looking at your articles for ideas on what and how to teach parents to engage with their children. Most families I work with are Asian, and they are more passive and totally not into praising and being exciting and bubbly. They are more strict and have high expectations, and she has in parentheses, like, in quotes, answer me right now, for their children, and I can feel that their kids do not answer because they are feeling put on the spot. I wish I can introduce ways to be their own therapist to their children in spite of the barrier that I feel the parents put up. How do you deal with that? With parents who might be resistant to big changes because it affects their entire philosophy and cultural upbringing. She says, in any case, thank you for the website, the articles, and the DVDs. This is not as uncommon as you would think, that it would just really apply to certain cultures. I have lots of American families who say to me, I am just not going to be able to be that playful and that energetic and that fun. So it is something that I have parents say to me a lot. Do you hear that too, Kate?
I do. Yeah, I think a lot of people are, it's not necessarily natural. It's natural for some people and not so natural for others. But, yeah, they feel very uncomfortable kind of ratcheting it up to that level.
Right. You know, and what I try to tell them in the most gentle, kindest way that I can is, well, if your way were going to work, I probably wouldn't be here right now. And that just kind of sets the whole stage for we need to do something differently. And just speaking to him in your normal, average conversational voice and just having him try to pick up language, whether it be a receptive problem, an expressive problem, or both, during daily routines is not working. So how about we try my play stuff that I'm going to teach you how to do for a little while, and if it doesn't work, then we can talk about what else might work. But until then, let's try it this way. And I think you can get most parents on board with the idea that they need to be this way to be playful and fun and energetic during playtime. And then if they want to go back to being their normal way during the rest of their daily routines. Well, I can't really do anything about that. And you're not really going to change someone's entire personality by one visit or, you know, especially with her, you know, with a conversation that she might be having with those parents. So I think just introducing this, like, this is what we'll need to do during our therapy time, and it is very important that you play with your child because, again, if he were going to learn language just by picking it up from your everyday environment and the experiences that you're already doing, it would have already happened that way. So we need to change to do something differently. And one thing I almost always ask parents to do is implement the one-on-one playtime with mommy and or daddy. And try to keep it, you know, 20, 30 minutes a day and then build up to several episodes like that through the day. And some moms are great at dropping everything and playing just whenever the opportunity arises. And some moms really do have to schedule it and really do have to make it something that they think about, or they might go 2 or 3 days without really addressing the things that we're working on in therapy, and they're still maybe giving them choices during snack time or talking with them as they take a bath. But then when we really sit down and look at it, and, you know, I've had great moms who are so brutally honest with me, and they would say, you know, it had been 2 or 3 days before I realized that I haven't even played with her like you've been wanting me to. So I think making that a part of your initial conversations with parents, and with some parents it's easier to do. Some parents it's hard. I mean, I'll have a hard time doing it, and I've been doing this for a long time and feel like, you know, parent training is something that I naturally do, that it's part of my practice. But, you know, there are some parents that are harder to talk to about that and introduce that kind of concept than others. So you kind of just have to take a big, deep breath and think, I hope I don't offend this person, and try to word it in the nicest way that you can, but pretty much say, we need to make some changes here and talk about that. And I think the most important thing that you can do as a therapist, too, is to really model how you want them to play with your child and let them see your child's responses, because that's what happens a lot with me, Kate, and I'm sure it does with you too. The parent sees how excited the kid gets, how the kid stays with you, how he starts following directions, how he doesn't get up and walk away. He's right there. He's got those twinkly little eyes that you talk about, Kate, and he's just so engaged in what you're doing. And then they start to see some signs or hear some words, and they get so excited and think, okay, she might have a point here. I think I can learn how to do this too. And so until a therapist can really model how to do that and show a parent how that looks, it's going to be really hard to just talk about and get any real follow-through, I think.
Right. And I do, I mean, that's, pardon me, an advantage we have of being there in the trenches where, you know, the comfort of being in their homes. And a lot of times I see kind of a gradual coming around or improvement in how the parents do engage with
right.
the kids, because they kind of become like, okay, I've heard it enough, I think I can handle that, and they're kind of
right.
desensitized to their discomfort level, and lo and behold, it does improve over time. It would be harder in a classroom setting where the parents may not have the luxury of just hanging out there
Watching, and
actually seeing it, but I do think a lot of parents in the beginning think, oh, no way, that's just not
yeah.
me. But then when they've been around it enough, eventually becomes like, yeah, I guess I could probably come close to that. And I do think
I
that,
could fake that.
Yeah. Right. And you know what? I hate to say, but certainly there are times I'm faking it. You know what I mean?
Right. When yeah, me too.
I'm thinking, I really don't want to go in and play and be so energetic and, you know, engaged myself, but it's so rewarding when you actually do it, because it's so productive as far as getting the child to engage back with you and to, you know, jump through the hoops you want them to jump through, whether it be give you words, give you signs, give you response of something. You know, you see there's such a qualitative difference between it's not necessarily what you do all the time, but oftentimes it's just how you do it. You know,
right.
And parents, I hear this one a lot more. I'm sure you do as well. Well, why will he sit and do that puzzle with you? Well, why will he sit and, you know, and it's like, well, because, it's, you know, is this the way you do it? You know,
right.
And the answer is, no, probably not. You know, they're not
right.
saying, all right, get the dog. dog? Where's the dog? Woof, woof, woof. You know, goofy, goofy, fun, fun, fun. That's what gets them going, and that's what keeps them with you. And, you know, a kid who just has a real hard time sitting and focusing or is so easily distracted by all the other things going on, you know, that's what they need to keep them with you long enough for them to absorb what it is we want them to absorb. And so, anyway.
And that's why I think that parents sometimes have to really think. It's too hard for them to think, okay, I have to be like this 24/7. But they can bring themselves to do it half an hour in the morning, half an hour in the afternoon. And it is a little easier when you think about it. And basically, you know, when you and I are going in to do home visits, that's what we're doing. We're
right.
doing 45, 50 minutes of play and the rest of the, you know, kind of counting the time to get there, to sit down and get there to leave. We're not there to wash the dishes. We're not there to answer the phone. We're not there to do the laundry. All those things, tend to the other children, you know, hopefully. Sometimes we do have to do that, but hopefully not. So, you know, you do have to just sort of block out that time so that you're dedicated for play, and I think it does make it easier to kind of shift into that playful, fun, I'm here totally enraptured in what you, my little child, is doing, and I'm going to block out all those other distractions too, and then it makes it easier for your kid to do it. And I do think once you see it, it's good. What I would recommend that this teacher do is that she develop her own little set of parent training things so that they can kind of see either videos, some things in the classroom that she might want to show parents during conferences, or she could take advantage of all those DVDs that I've done and really loan parents copies of those or encourage parents to get on and look at the website and take a look at the clips or buy the DVDs themselves. Because the reason that I did the DVDs is because it is easier to do it after you've seen it. It's a lot harder for parents when they don't have that kind of personality or that kind of inclination to know how to do it just from reading about it or from someone telling you about it. That would be even worse probably as a parent to, you know, kind of be like a finger wagging, you're not doing it correctly, without even an explanation of here's a better way. So that might be something that she would want to do too. And frankly, that's the reason I did the DVDs, is so that I would have something to leave with parents and then, you know, use as a training tool. So maybe that's something she could do as well.
I don't want to leave the impression that we think parents are somehow inadequate or just don't get
no.
it. The truth is there are lots of therapists who don't
yeah.
get it. Hey, I'll go out there and say it, Laura, because so often, you know, over time since you made the DVDs and you have the website and stuff, you get a lot of feedback, or sometimes we do, you know, for this show about basically I had this therapist for X number of months, I got the DVDs, I saw what it was supposed to look like. We've moved on with therapists because
right.
a lot of therapists take a really kind of passive, watch what the kid does, kind of follow the child's lead, and we're, you know, that's not necessarily, I think our approach is rather neutral in that we like to take some of the lead, we like to direct it to some extent, we also like
mm-hmm.
to think that we're open to following the child's lead on some things, but there are quite a few therapists that I cross paths with who really don't take much lead, and they kind of follow the child around, and a lot of these kids are pretty darn good at moving, and so it's kind of like the child runs around and the therapist runs around and maybe sticks a word in now and again, and there's not a lot of true interaction, and there's not really a whole lot of communication either. So, you know, it's not obvious to even a lot of speech therapists or DIs or whichever therapist we're talking about. So, but it's not hard. It's just not, I think, Laura, you learned in the trenches years ago and have perfected it over the years. But it's not, you know, the average approach to speech therapy. And I think parents figure that out once they've had a speech therapist for a while, get the DVD, and then say,
there might be a different way to do this. Yeah.
That is not what my sessions for my little boy look like at all. Because
right.
they're not, you know, they're not getting that twinkle. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're not getting the twinkle, you're probably not getting your kid's best effort. And, you know, all we can, and I tell myself this routinely, all we can really change is what we do. You know, I mean,
right.
Our ultimate goal is to change what the child is able to do, but, you know, what we have control
in the beginning.
Yeah.
Especially it's what you're doing. And, you know, a lot of parents do have this gift naturally, and a lot of times I'll go in and I see this especially with kids that this happens a lot, kids that some people don't think are on the spectrum because the kid is a little bit social, but he's got all these other quirks or characteristics, and I'll go in and think, okay, the reason that this person is not thinking that you are on the autism spectrum is because your mommy and daddy have worked their hinies off for 2 years now, laughing with you and getting in your face and being cute and playing because they know naturally kind of how to get that social piece going and are pretty skilled at it. And then you end up with a kid that might still have a language delay and some sensory issues and some other little quirks, but they don't look nearly as isolated or withdrawn or self-absorbed as they would have had they had a different set of parents. And the difference has been their parents have kind of instinctively known how to play and what to do. So I see that a lot too, where I have parents that are doing a great job and I think, boy, how would this kid look with a different set of parents that weren't as in tune or as internally motivated?
I know one of them, Laura,
motivated.
Was cheerleader mommy. You talk about her. She's so great. She's a cheerleader mommy. And that's exactly it. She had that instinctively. That was just her personality.
Right.
And she knew how to implement it, and it really did benefit her child. But I think a lot of parents aren't, you know, I always say you need a license to have drive a car. Perhaps we should have a license to have a child. I don't think a lot of parents really are that comfortable playing with their kids, and then if you factor in that kids with language delays aren't necessarily the easiest kids to play with in the first place,
right.
Not always, but certainly sometimes that's
sometimes,
you know, also a challenge. You know, I have two kids who are grown, but I would say it took me, I'm better at playing with young children now than I was prior to doing this job, even when I had kids. I think I played, but my kids were fairly easy to play with. And
right.
I didn't have to work at it all that much.
Well, and as you always say, the truth is, with typically developing kids, you really don't have to do that.
No.
Because they naturally pick up language, and they're quite content to bug you to death if you don't play with them. I mean, they don't really, they demand attention.
Mm-hmm.
They are really initiating communication with their mommies and daddies, so it's not hard for those moms and dads to really play back with them because those kids instinctively know how to do it, and they make sure that their needs are met. And even if their moms and dads aren't great players, the kids do great anyway,
right,
because they're typically developing. They're not predisposed to have those developmental delays and challenges. So you don't really have to be a great player with those kinds of kids, because they do just pick up those words and those social cues, and they do just kind of learn through osmosis. It just naturally happens. But with language delay kids, you have to do things differently. There is no way around it. If a speech pathologist tells you in early intervention, oh, you can just do this a couple of times a day in your daily routines and your kid will get better, don't believe them. You know, you really are going to have to make a concerted effort to change how you interact with them. And this is particularly true for children who have social issues, who aren't making, and what I mean by that they're not making eye contact with you, that they seem in their own little worlds, that they don't really have much interest in doing anything other than what they want to do, that they aren't really having that great joint attention that we've talked about so much in the past few weeks with their toys. You know, they're doing their own thing a lot of the time. So
independent is one of the first words you think of to describe your toddler, then this is the approach you need. And I do hear that. Oh, he's just so independent. He's happy to go off and do his own thing. You know.
Yeah, and I have to really talk to moms about how, okay, that's not so great.
Uh-huh.
Because you do think, oh, he's such a good baby. He just sat there. He doesn't really bother me for much of anything. Ding, 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 ding. We have a problem. Because even as a tiny baby, you know, once they get kind of past that little newborn stage, they should really start putting together, if I cry, my mommy runs in here, and start to perfect that little whine, even, you know, as they get 6 months, 9 months, you know, and that's early communication where kids have learned that. You know, I remember, you know, my children, we were so blessed that none of them struggled with language, and they would really learn pretty quick that, you know, which was so communicative, even from the swing, mm-hmm. with, oh, if I do that, my mom's going to get right in here. She's going to put that cell phone down and look at me. She's going to quit watching that TV and see what's up. And so, you know, those initiations, that's part of normal language development. And so if you have a child who really is content not to really do much of that, and you're really still guessing what he wants at two, that's where we need to start to work with him, with really learning that, oh, I need to do something to get something. I need to learn how to get my mommy's attention. I need to enjoy being with her. And most of the time, that's most successful in play, if you start there. So that's what we talk about every week. But there's another question that's really related to that. But I'm going to try to stick to our order today. I don't know why I'm feeling so structured and rigid, but we're just going to move along with the next question. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Yeah, quite a different approach than how we normally are, isn't it?
I'll try not to present questions out of order this week. Yes, you go ahead and I'll follow your lead.
Next week we'll be back to our loosey-goosey. Today we're going to get through these five questions. And, you know, mainly the reason I want to do it is because I told all of these people, some of these people last week, that we would answer their questions on the podcast last week, and we didn't. And I've told some of these other people, listen in today for this answer. So I really want to try to stay a little bit more focused than I always am. Okay, the next one is from a mom, and she says, hi, Laura. My almost three-year-old is getting speech therapy and special ed therapy. I guess that would mean what you do, Kate, developmental intervention. He has difficulty processing new information. He needs to hear a new word at least 100 times and in different ways to acquire the word, and the same with a new skill. So he needs lots and lots of repetition. She says he has difficulty labeling items. Even if he is very familiar with something, he can have difficulty naming it. He can pretend play if he is taught, but he won't initiate any imaginative actions on his own. A lot of his talking is echolalic. By that, she means that he just repeats what someone has already said to him, or either he might quote lines from a show or a book or something. She says, when I ask him a question, he'll either repeat the question or totally ignore me. His therapists are working with him for about 2 months now, and we're seeing some progress, but very slow moving. And this is her question. She says, his special ed therapist told me to have his hearing evaluated to rule out any hearing loss. And I guess that's because she sees him ignore what mom says. She says, now his articulation is perfect, and he hears even very quiet sounds. Is there any possibility that he has any sort of hearing loss? She says, I would do anything for him, but I don't feel like wasting time to go check this out if it is totally far-fetched. All right, so she's wanting to know, should she have a hearing assessment, even though in her heart of hearts she's saying hearing is not the problem. Do you want to answer this, Kate, or do you want me to just talk about what I've already said to this mom? Why don't you go ahead?
Okay, I'll take a stab at it. I will say there are lots of times in our system, I come in, and I think I know you do as well, Laura, once they've had what we call a primary level evaluation, and that may be a speech therapist, that may be a PT, that may be an OT. More often than not, it's a speech therapist for the kids we see. But in any case,
right,
whoever that individual is, they routinely, particularly speech therapists, recommend get a hearing eval for any child who's language delayed, because it's kind of like you would feel pretty silly if you saw a child for 6 or 8 or 12 months and then at the end of that realized, well, he really couldn't hear me. So it's a little
mm-hmm.
wonder that he doesn't respond appropriately, or he doesn't isn't able to use words, you know, at the level he should, because he didn't really hear me. That being said, I think, yeah, it probably is a good idea to rule that out. Do I suspect with this child that this mother's right? Yes, I do.
Yeah, me too.
I doubt it's his hearing, but in the big picture, you know, I understand the hassle, go get it. I mean, I did the little kids' things. We had our things to take care of, and it is. It's a hassle. On the other hand, she's putting forth way more effort to get all that therapy. She's, you know, in the big picture, one hearing assessment really isn't such a hassle that I would say, oh, just ignore that and assume it's fine. Is it probably? Yes, it is. But I would still say, in the interest of being overly cautious, rule that out. And you'll say at the end, I knew it wasn't his hearing, and it probably isn't. I'd say the odds are very slim. But, you know, normally that's ruled out. I don't know. I'm assuming they're not here in Louisville, Kentucky, because really they always, from the get-go, recommend hearing eval, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty standard. Mm-hmm. And I think that most speech-language pathologists in every state, that's one of the first recommendations that you make. The only thing that I would say is if this mom had to pay for it totally out of pocket and money were an issue,
right,
that might be the only time that I would say, well,
not so sure I'd rest to that.
Right.
Yeah.
But now, everything
I don't even know if I'm right about this. Does First Steps in Kentucky pay for all hearing assessments?
Yes.
So here,
and so if you're
it's
in
not an out-of-pocket expense. It would be just
right.
A hassle of taking your child and enduring it. This may well be a child who's not going to like hearing evals. There are certainly,
right.
If he has some
you know,
issues, which, you know, she doesn't talk about that, but with what else he has going on, it sure wouldn't surprise me if he did. And then
right, and if he goes and it's a horrible assessment and they say, well, we don't really know, now you need to get an ABR, and an ABR is a test that you have done at the hospital under anesthesia, or you could have it done at a hearing center, you know, outpatient. But most of the time here, they have them done at a children's hospital, and, again, it's under anesthesia. And in that case, I would tell her, okay, do what you want to do, but we don't really think it's hearing. You know, this sounds like a language processing problem.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, you might take a second look. But if money is not an issue and she doesn't really have to pay for a lot of that herself, I would just go ahead and do it so you can check it off the list and know that you're just ruling things out like we do everything else. Don't we take our children to the doctor sometimes for strep tests and things like that when you think, she does not have strep. But if I don't go take her in, I'm not going to really, really know, and I'm going to feel horrible when she's still running a fever 5 days later that I haven't gone ahead and gotten her in there when I really suspected that it was the allergies all along. You know, those kinds of things, these are what we do as parents. So try to look at it like that as one of the other little rule-out things you would do.
Yeah, she doesn't really specify whether it's just the sound booth kind of test or the ABR. I'm assuming it's just the sound booth. I would agree with you on the ABR, and unfortunately, it wouldn't surprise me because so many times kids with delays and, you know, if he has processing problems, which it sounds like he kind of does with comprehension
right.
And all, wouldn't surprise me if this is a child who isn't going. Some kids go in there, you know, they're 24 months, they sail right through it, they actually kind of enjoy it. There's nothing painful about it, but, you know, it's kind of overwhelming for some kids who don't tolerate strangers well, who don't tolerate being touched well, who don't, you know, all
right.
Of you know, those same kids who hate their haircuts, they hate their hearing evals too.
They do. And, you know, sometimes it really does depend on the skill of the examiner. So if she has some concerns about that and thinks, oh, this will be a disaster because he will just be so bad, she should really ask her speech pathologist and her other therapist, who is the very best pediatric audiologist that we have, who is really good with kids. And then you're able to kind of tell. And then we have, you know, several options here in town, but we have, you know, I know who I can say for different parents' personalities and for their needs, you know, who might be a better fit, because I know that one place kind of gets them in and gets them out of there, and that's who I would probably refer a kid like this to. Whereas other moms that really want every shell unturned, that practice might not be the best place for them. They might not think it's as professional because that doc is able to kind of get them in and get them out. So that might be something she just wants to share those individual concerns with the therapist and say, you know, for his situation, is there somebody that might be better just to make sure that they still get an accurate test, but at the same time address any quirks he might have as far as testing goes.
So I guess our final answer is we really pretty much agree with the mom, but we still professionally have to say
yeah.
You probably have the hearing assessment. I mean, you know, I mean,
I know,
that's pretty
yeah,
much
I think that's the summary, yeah.
She can do without
do it anyway.
What she chooses to do, I mean, I totally understand her position, and I think she's probably right. But, you know, I've had lots of kids whose moms are saying, I don't think he has a hearing problem, and I'm thinking, no, neither do I. But,
right.
You know.
Do it anyway. Yeah.
How silly would we feel if we just said, oh, it couldn't possibly be. And the fact is there are kids who have some fluid problems where, yes, they hear, but they don't hear clearly. They don't hear well.
Right.
They, you know, that fluctuates.
Right.
And you really only know that if you test their hearing. A kid with perfect articulation probably hears, but
You still want to rule it out. I would if it's not going to cost you a lot of money and if you don't have huge concerns about other things. If it's just a standard sound booth test, I would go ahead and do it. Listen, I do have a story that, do you remember the little boy I saw several years ago? He was a real late referral. I didn't get him until he was probably 33 months old, so I only saw him for 3 months. But his doctor had recommended that he have an audiological eval at 2, and they did it and never got the results, and then the little boy never got sick or anything, and then he went back at 33 months. So from 24 months to 33 months, you know, really didn't need to see the doctor. And he went back in, and the doctor realized that he had hearing loss during that time, and pretty significant hearing loss, but it was just in one ear. And, you know, sometimes people think that those unilateral hearing losses aren't a big deal, but all the research really talks about how those kids really do need intervention because they go on to have a pretty significant difference with their academic performance as they get older.
Hmm.
And so this little boy went all that time and still wasn't talking and still wasn't really developing with language. And his parents, you know, didn't get services that whole time because they didn't really get the results of the hearing assessment. And so I think about a thing like that, and they really thought he was fine,
uh-huh.
even though he had the assessment. And I just think, oh, my goodness, that, you know, what a nightmare that was for that practice with trying to, you know, address what, who dropped the ball there. You know, that was terrible. So anyway, a little bit of a related story, loosely related.
Right.
But you do want to do it just kind of to rule it out. All right, moving right along. Next question. This mom says, hi, I have a son who's 2.5 years old. He has most of the mentioned, almost all of the things above. And she wrote into the website at teachmetotalk.com under an article called, I think it's Could My Toddler Be Autistic? It was one of those kind of general list things where I think I compiled a bunch of characteristics of children with autism as reported by parents, and so she's looked at this list and said, he has almost all those. I'm really worried about him. He's not even walking yet, and so I'm sure when I read this the first time, I thought, 2.5 and not walking? And she says, he manages to stand, but not unaided. He's not saying any words, flapping his arms when he gets excited. He loves spinning things, hears the most quiet noises, cries when I put on the kettle, the microwave, the washing machine, etc. He even cries when I'm on the phone or my husband talks to me in a loud voice. Boy, that would be a crying kid at my house because we were all loud. She says he has a lot of tantrums.
Happy camper at the Mises home, huh?
No, we are all loud. He has a lot of tantrums, doesn't wave by, plays with his toys quietly, has some sleeping problems, gets severely constipated where he ends up bleeding. Is this a sign of autism? She says he does smile back when he's smiled at. He likes it when his grandparents, uncles, and aunties come around. He enjoys playing with his brother. He eats well. He does respond to his name, but only when it's feeding time. Thanks. So after I took a really couple of deep breaths, my response to her was, get him assessed today. You know, not walking at 2.5 is really delayed. Most children walk by, typically developing children, by 15 months. 18 months would be the outer edge of that. But 2.5, that's a full year later than what we would want to see walking. So that in and of itself, I'm having a hard time believing that the pediatrician missed. So I really encouraged her to get professional intervention as soon as possible. It sounds like she might be from another country. Some of her wordage there sounds like she's probably from England, don't you think, Kate?
I don't remember what country I thought, but I do remember thinking, yes, this might be somebody's second language, or the way it's written is it does sound somehow.
Well, she said kettle, and I don't know. I think that's an English word, or Australian, I don't know, somewhere besides America. Mm-hmm. So that could be it, too, because I know other countries, especially countries, and I'm just going to go say it, with socialized medical systems, do not always pay attention to developmental issues like they should, and do not have the super system that we have in the United States, even though early intervention is a federally mandated program and states get federal money for it. It is still not, we still do a good job of identifying children with developmental issues from birth to three. And so some other countries don't value that as much as our country does. So I'll get off the soapbox about that now. But anyway, I really encouraged her as strongly as I've ever encouraged anyone in a written response on the website, get him tested, get some professional help, talk to your pediatrician. So she wrote me back a day or two later, and she says, my son's got a neurology appointment in 2 weeks. They've also referred him to an early start team physiotherapy, which I just can't believe anybody in America would say physiotherapy. But they might, audiology, speech therapy, and I need to go to a special needs group. They don't know what the problem is yet. She says, my son is not even feeding himself. When he drinks milk, I need to feed it to him. And granted, he's 2.5. When he holds a spoon, he doesn't put it in his mouth. He won't even put a crisp into his mouth. So, again, another little word that we probably wouldn't use.
Yeah, he sounds pretty British, isn't he?
Yeah, she said he just looks like a baby. I know he's having a developmental delay, but from what I've told you, do you know what it could be? Any advice would be of help, as he looks fine, but is just having a severe delay. So she's meaning that he doesn't have any physical-looking issues. And she says, he is also 34 weeks. She says premature, and I guess she means he was born at 34 weeks. Thank you. And so he was about 6 weeks early, but let me say, for all the mommies of premature children that are listening, we stop correcting for prematurity when they turn 2. So once you have a child that's 2, if he's not caught up, even if prematurity is still kind of the reason that he's not caught up, we still don't look at it like, help me out here, Kate. He should have already been caught up. If nature were going to take its course, prematurity corrects itself by 2. So you don't want to keep saying at 2.5, he's just a late walker because he was 6 weeks early. You know, there is a big problem because he is doing, it's not only late walking, late talking, he's not self-feeding, which we would think should come in by, 12 months. So he has huge delays. Again, I would just want to kick the healthcare worker or pediatrician or whoever to the curb and start over with someone else who is paying a little more attention and really do some pretty serious and intense intervention with this little guy, because he sounds like he's going to need a lot of help if he is going to catch up.
Right. He's, globally delayed in all areas. And, she's asking about autism. I personally, in 10 years plus of doing this, have not had a child that I either, there was a firm diagnosis or I suspected we were dealing with autism, who didn't walk by 2.5. A lot of kids
right.
on the spectrum, I think, tend to be a little bit late in their walking. That's not uncommon. A little bit late. They're the 15-month-olders.
That's like 15 to 18
they're
months.
They're the 16-monthers. Yeah.
yeah,
they're not, On the
not
other end,
and a half.
Who had a diagnosis of autism who walked at 11 months. So
right.
they're not all late walkers, but I don't mean to say that.
Right.
They can be late walkers, but not 2.5. Never. I've never seen that personally. And, it sounds like he has very significant sensory issues with all of his auditory sensitivities. I mean, not
right.
being able to handle loud voices, even of his parents, he's really got a lot of sensory issues going on, and that may be at the root of the I don't sell feed because I don't want to touch that, and I'll sit here and
right.
be passive and you can feed me. We don't know. You know, it could be any number of things. It could be a combination of things. It could be autism
right.
plus something else. It could be...
Exactly.
You know,
that's what I was going to say.
She's. I'll say this. She got her ducks in a row very quickly. I'm really glad that she communicated with you and that you gave her the feedback you did because, you know, in the course of 2 days, she got, what, four or five different appointments with...
She got it going. Yeah.
Yeah.
She really did.
Mm-hmm.
So that is commendable, and I hope we hear back from this mom and she lets us know what's going on with him. And I would just go ahead and tell you this will not probably be a quick fix. I'm glad you're seeing a neurologist because it does sound like there's something neurological that's going on. I would not be shocked at all if if that were the case, if you don't get some news there. It could be, like though Kate said, kind of a sensory stuff is at the root of all of this. I think it probably is in addition to some other
right.
things going on
in
because these are pretty
right.
significant delays. Yeah. She doesn't say that she's getting occupational therapy. She says she's, getting the early intervention team, physiotherapy, audiology, speech therapy, and she's going to go to a special need group. I hope an occupational therapist takes a look at him at some point to address the sensory needs. And if this mom is listening, add that to your list. Call your person who's coordinating your services and say, I also would like an occupational therapy evaluation. If he's going to get the once-over, someone is probably going to address that. But while you're in the assessment mode, go ahead and have an OT assessment, too, if you can get it. So there we go with that. All right. So, again, congratulations to her, though, for getting that going and pursuing those services. So that's great. All right, let's move on. 17 minutes for two questions. Can we do it? Let's see. Okay, this mom says, hi, I'm very glad I found this site. And she's talking about the website. She says, my son is 33 months old. He was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder by a developmental pediatrician in November 2009. So that was just this last November. Okay, so she's had this diagnosis about 7 months. Therapist who specialize in autism started coming to our house, and with therapy, I have seen improvement. Yay! The problem is some therapists don't think he has autism, and they don't mind coming out and saying it. Okay, she has therapists like us, doesn't she?
Uh-oh.
Outspoken therapist. She says, that makes it hard for me because I don't know who to believe. I noticed signs of possible autism very early on. My son never explored my face when I would feed him his bottle as an infant. He never, in all caps, answered to his name, and when he started therapy, they documented that he answered to his name only 10% of the time. And now, 5 months later, it's 60% of the time, so he's coming along. He's making some good progress. She says his eye contact is inconsistent, and he seems to have all the therapist agree, echolalia and delayed echolalia. If you ask him... what's your name? He will say, what's name? If you ask him how old you are, he'll say, old are you? He can memorize and sing long country songs. That cracks me up. And will recite phrases from movies or TV randomly throughout the day. His expressive and receptive language are at about the 1 year, 9 month level, even though he's almost three. He does flap on occasion, but it's gotten better now that we have been using PECS, which is the picture exchange communication system. And for parents who don't know about that, you can Google that or Google it or look it up on my website. She says he used to only play with anything with wheels or his roller coaster beads. Now with therapy, he will play with other things, but prefers to play alone. He's always lined things up, locks, cars, stuffed animals. He loves to rock, and he likes deep pressure on his head, his hands, and his legs. He's about to start school, and I'm afraid some of the opinions of him of not having autism of some of the staff will affect him or his right to therapies. They already refused to give him occupational therapy, even though his adaptive skills are at the 9 month to a year old with eating, feeding himself, and dressing. What can I do? And in your personal opinion, do you think the developmental pediatrician was correct about him having autism spectrum disorder? Thank you. I can see this mom's point, because sometimes parents... there are some parents who are so desperate not to get an autism diagnosis that they will do everything they can to avoid that because they don't want their children labeled. And then I have to really talk them through it and say, now let's look at the consequences of this. If he doesn't have a diagnosis, he may not get all the therapy that he qualifies for. And this mom has figured that out on her own. She's saying, okay, if they go against this physician's, this developmental pediatrician's opinion that he has autism, he might not get all the things that he should get when he goes to preschool. And she says, you know, they've already said he can't have OT, and I don't understand. So I totally understand her concern with thinking autism is the way to go here, because even if he looks borderline to some of these therapists, I want to make sure that he keeps that very recognizable diagnosis that gives him the best chance possible of getting all the services he can get. And, you know, she doesn't say that it looks like it's just through school, but some parents will, we talk about that for their insurance coverage too. Their insurance is much more likely to pay for therapies after a child turns 3 and ages out of our early intervention program if they have a diagnosis like autism. So I think this mom is doing a great job of thinking ahead and really measuring and trying to do what's best for her son and thinking about all the possible outcomes rather than just jumping up and down and saying, woohoo, he doesn't have autism. And I think she's right to kind of question that and say, okay, this professional said he does, and now you're telling me that he doesn't. I just would rather err on the side of caution and go with he does so that he can get more services. And frankly, Kate, we don't know whether he's on the spectrum or not because we can't see him.
Right. Although, you know.
Go ahead and say it. I'm waiting.
Well, no, you don't know what I'm going to say. Am I that predictable? No, I would say a couple things. One is, all things being equal, which they're not, the best qualified person on that team to determine whether or not that child is autistic is the developmental pediatrician. Short of that, a psychologist is really who I think a
right.
good psychologist. You know, my mantra on autism, it's a very gray area.
Yeah, that's what I was waiting on you to say.
Yeah, that's but what I usually say.
It looks like a duck, it acts like a duck.
No, walks like a duck, talks like a duck. I mean, does it sound like he's on the spectrum? Yes, it does. Can I see?
From her report, it does.
It
yeah.
does. I mean, just based on what she said, I wouldn't have a problem. You know, is he going to be high functioning? Yes, probably so. You know,
right.
it sounds like he's
because he's making progress.
Mm-hmm. He's making progress. He's pretty verbal. Has the ability to talk. He's going to be verbal. You know, more so as he gets older. The prognosis looks pretty good. Does that exclude a diagnosis of autism? No.
No.
Although there are professionals and of any given discipline, whether it be a psychologist or a developmental pediatrician or an OT or a PT or a speech therapist or a DI, who think if he's that high functioning, he couldn't possibly be autistic. I don't necessarily agree with that position. And in a perfect world, there'd be a very objective way to rule out and say, you know, there isn't, you know, all of these things are pretty darn subjective in my opinion. And if you ask one expert, they'd say absolutely not. And the next expert might very well say, yes, he is on the spectrum. So.
And sometimes a child can vary that much.
Yeah.
From one day or from one setting. You see them, you know, and sometimes it goes the opposite way. You would think naturally, okay, I'm going to take this child in to be evaluated in this hospital center, in this hospital setting, and he's going to do terrible. Oh, my goodness, I've had several children through the years, and I'm thinking of them right now, that had the best day of their lives.
Uh-huh.
When
for
they
some
went.
Reason. Yeah.
For some weird reason. And so they did not do the things that they normally do. And I always think, gosh, you were so shut down when you were there that you didn't look spectrum anymore. You didn't do your self-STEMI stuff while you were there. You were so caught in headlights that you didn't you know, exhibit some of these very real behaviors that you normally do, or for whatever reason, they're really in tune to what's going on and might answer a few questions or pop out a few words, and lo and behold, they fool the whole darn team. So sometimes that happens too. It is pretty subjective from professional to professional, and sometimes kids are just so unpredictable with either they do lots worse or lots better than they do on any given day.
Right, and I totally understand why parents want a definitive answer. You know, why?
Yeah.
I certainly would too. But the fact is, it just isn't that kind of diagnosis. Maybe in 20 or 30 years, they'll have a test that they can run. They'll have a CT scan, or they'll have some scientific, measurable
DNA
way.
Test. Yeah.
At this
you're gonna
point,
look at
what
your
they have
genes.
Is
yeah.
subjective tests. There are certainly things that they, certain tests that they administer, but a lot of it comes down to interpretation on how did this child respond, what did I see, and the best people look at kids across a number of different settings and a number of different times so they get the best reflection they can possibly get. But even then, it comes down to his or her professional opinion, really.
Right.
Even though
really.
People would defend that and say, no, it's a test. And I'm like, well, it's not like a test for meningitis, you know, where you can say.
It's not positive or negative.
Right.
Yeah.
The fact is that it is a spectrum. There are kids who are really pretty high functioning who end up doing very well, ultimately, make great progress. Lots of people wouldn't know they were autistic if they were around them as they get older. Other kids, you know, and people have different standards that they apply as far as who they think qualifies. I think she makes a good point that, you know, she's obviously come to terms with or has, you know, begun to come to terms with he is autistic. And she has an expert who has documented that, I'm sure, and I think she's probably wise to use that as support for the most amount of therapy he can get, whether it be in the school system or through her private insurance or both. Nobody wants that diagnosis, of course, but if she's accepted that, yes, that's probably what it is, she is not making a mistake to use that as part of her support for as much intervention as she can possibly get her child. And it does, I think, make it harder to deny services when you have something concrete, you know, whether it be Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or another different syndrome or autism, as opposed to he's delayed, you know.
Right.
It shouldn't probably, but it probably does help as far as this is why, this is what the concrete label we have to describe my child. And the fact is that all those kids on the spectrum are all really quite different from one another, but they get the blanket term, you know, autism spectrum disorder, and that keeps some doors open that might not be open if she didn't have that label.
Right. And I understand from a therapist's perspective thinking, okay, this child has been misdiagnosed. But even if I felt that way, I would not want to say or do anything that really kept a child or limited a child's access to services.
Right.
So I think if the mom takes a position like that, like I am thrilled with his progress. I think you guys are an amazing team, and we are so lucky to have had you. However, life goes on after three, and I'm still going to need services for him, and what you're saying could really jeopardize that, and so I'd like for you to remove that from your notes or really, really, really talk me through this, because from where I'm standing and looking at him, he's still got some issues here, and we're still going to need some help, and I'm afraid you're screwing this up for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think any therapist would respond to a parent's plea from that perspective.
Right.
And it doesn't sound like, you know, sometimes we have fights with school administrators who don't want to give a child services because they don't feel like he meets eligibility requirements, and they're trying to balance, you know, how many children they have to serve, blah, 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 blah. It's not anything like that. I mean, she should really be getting full support of the therapist on her child's team. And if they don't think he's on the spectrum, they need to be coming up with another diagnosis or something, again, besides developmental delay. I mean, he, from how the mom describes him, that would still be a pretty, I would be comfortable with saying that that's probably right on.
And we're, yeah. This is all theoretical because we don't know this child. And
we haven't seen him, team, yeah.
But based on what she described, I think my personal response would be, wow, he's on the spectrum. Well, the future looks pretty good for him. He's going to do pretty well, I'm going to assume. He's made great progress. I'm very happy with, and, you know, undoubtedly the mother is as well. But to me, just because a child does make good progress or doesn't display some of those classically autistic behaviors the way he did 6 months prior doesn't mean, okay, he's come out of that. That's not appropriate anymore.
That's why we do therapy.
Right.
Yeah, that's why we do therapy. You know, I think they should really be, again, patting themselves on the back and saying, boy, we are great at what we do, but don't take his diagnosis away if it's going to mean that he won't get the services that he needs. So I think this mom is in an interesting position, and I hope that she writes us back and lets us know how this goes, because that certainly is in a position that lots of mothers find themselves in, but some might, and so it's interesting. So I hope that she'll keep us informed and that she'll continue to do everything that she can to advocate for her child, because it sounds like she's doing a great job with that and that she really has his best interest at heart long term. So there you go. Okay. I do not think that we are going to have time to do this last question, and I hope that the mom that sent this in, she has a 21-month-old little boy, and he doesn't talk at all, and he's got a lot of these behavior issues, that she will listen in next week, because I really want to talk about some real specific ideas that I have for him. So sorry we didn't get to your question today. I think we did great getting four questions, four lengthy, complex questions. I know. It's because we had a goal. We may try this approach from now on. But in all seriousness, we'll get to your question next week. Thank you so much for sending it in. Any mom or professional who has a question for us, please email those to me at laura@teachmetotalk.com, or you can leave it on the Facebook page, also called teachmetotalk.com, or leave it as a comment on the website at teachmetotalk.com. My husband noticed today that I have so many unread questions on Blog Talk Radio. I didn't even know people could leave comments on Blog Talk Radio about the show. So I'm going to have to go take a look at that. So please don't leave me anything there, because we have not looked at those ever. So, again, shoot me an email at laura@teachmetotalk.com or leave it on the website. That'd be the best thing. And then we're going to start next week's show with this question to be sure that we address it. But then the real topic for next week's show is something that a new therapist sent. And, Kate, I think I sent that to you. I'm not sure. She said that she is just starting to do early intervention, and she has just found my website and just started listening to our shows and loves them. And she said she would like for us to share all those little tips that you don't learn in school with how to deal with families and how to make sure that you get off on the right foot and how to really, you know, she feels like she knows the theory, but how do you really make it work? Because she's kind of scared of going in people's homes, and she wants to know all our little secrets. So I think that will be a great show. I can't wait to do it. I've got a couple of articles from the website that I want to pull from, but I know you're going to come up with some exciting things for next week, and so we'll just talk through some of those things. So I think that'll be a great show, especially for professionals. And I think it'll even be good for moms, too, because we're going to tell you from a therapist perspective those things that your therapist might be too nice to tell you. So join us next week. We've got a great show lined up.
Sounds good. Thanks, Laura.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye.
Okay, bye.